I'm optimistic, but my optimism is very unfamiliar to most people, and so they don't recognize it, and that's fair enough. I mean, my optimism is I think it's most people's idea of total despair, actually. It's kind of recognizing and embracing our complete powerlessness. That's my optimism, that it is possible to do that, and that everything changes, you know, the more we're able to.
Yeah, I wouldn't even, I don't know if it's, yeah, I think you have a very certain, very particular idea of powerlessness that is probably, if you look at it, that it's not so powerless at all. I think what I liked a lot about your writing is this sort of idea, okay, let's just take a first step and look at things, you know, without judging them or without trying to throw anyone into prison and to plan our next revenge and sort of take out the pitchfork. let's look at these things together and just quietly and see them for what they are. And I think that's very powerful.
Yeah, well, I agree, but that's a paradox, isn't it? Because it's part of being able to look at those things and not try and fix them, I think, is recognizing that we are powerless to fix them. I mean, that's for me, at least personally, and that's also what I want to communicate, that we cannot fix the social problems or the cultural problems when we've been engineered by those very structures, so that whatever solutions we reproduce will be part of the problem.
I probably disagree with it, because there is, I mean, if we look at like freedom as the sort of the ability to investigate and recognize your determinations, whichever they are, physiologically, socially, historically, then you can at least, I mean, perhaps it's not going to be comprehensive what you can do, but you can at least sort of, I mean, you're the best example of that. If you're sort of engineered with trauma in a way, you know, to if your life is predetermined by trauma, that you're sort of revolting by this, by transforming it into something conscious to look at it and to also learn from it, and to also perceive their own traumas and their own struggles. And I would disagree with it. And I think a lot of it, I mean, okay, you can never know these things, you know, like I guess a problem, one of the big problems of the 20th century is that we've managed to concentrate violence so effectively, like let's say for the nuclear bomb, that it's very very easy for a small group of people to bring about complete chaos. But then again, that hasn't happened yet, so then I guess, suppose there needs to be at least some sense of sanity and self-preservation that this is not just being done, you know.
Sure, yeah. Well, I mean, I think there is a very cold and calculating kind of sanity at work.
Yeah, but I mean, to everybody, to me, that's always surprising. How does that not actually have happened yet? You know, why does that, how has that not gone? I mean, just I've been interested in politics for several years, and just the amounts of times where I thought a World War III was imminent is quite surprising. And perhaps it was, you know, like you can never know these things, but I guess it gets quite serious between Washington and Moscow or whatever. But.
Well, not if it's all theater, though. Well, not to the extent that these things are theater, like the Cuban Missile Crisis. That could have all been theatre. I mean, I have like two takes on this, and I'm never worried about World War III. I had a friend who did when I was, you know, when I was a teenager, adolescent. It was in the hottest patch, really, with Reagan and pre-Gorbachev. And he was definitely worried. But even then, I wasn't. I've never actually worried about nuclear bombs. I always had this sense that that was too big for human beings to be able to make the decision about. And that was a kind of quasi-spiritual perspective. Now I would say that that may be true, but I also think that social engineering is very different from what we think, and it's really hard to unpack it and understand it. And obviously I'm not claiming that I have done so, but to the small degree I have, it definitely persuades me that the programs extend beyond the lives of individuals. So the individuals who are pushing the social engineering programs didn't even invent them. And so it's as if they don't even have much elbow room within them. So like massive errors just don't happen, I don't think. Not until you have divine intervention, which whatever that might be, you know, like something that is just like an asteroid hits the planet. Obviously, social engineers can't do anything about that. Well, I guess they could fire a nuclear bomb at it, but you know what I mean. There are forces of nature that are more powerful than any human group. But beyond that, in terms of decisions on that scale, I don't really think that the people who are creating sustained chaos on Earth and insanity, really, what I'd say we live in an insane world. I don't think that they're insane in the usual sense. I think it's a very unusual kind of insanity. You know what I mean? Like, you're talking about hubris, that word hubris. I think that they have become gods in their own eyes in some way, and that from our point of view it could almost seem true, like the kind of knowledge that they're applying, it would seem godlike to us. That's my sense, even though I'm nervous about saying that, because I don't want to reify or deify our you know, our human handlers. But it's not like I think they're infallible or anything like that. Just that the sense I get is that events are being controlled and directed on this planet at a level that's almost beyond our comprehension, except that it's also very, very simple, because it relates to internal laws. But again, those bodily and psychic structures. So we can all go to them and actually understand the way that societies move and operate, and we can take charge of that in some way. I don't think we control it exactly, but we surrender to it. And it's very hard to put into words. Like I don't know what the right word is, but beholden to, or I'm convinced of a divine intelligence anyway that's moving everything. But I'm, you know, it's a lifetime's work to actually fully connect to that and just let it take over. So that's my idea of real power, is complete surrender to that, and somehow looking at the way that our society has built this prison around us, and understanding that somehow that's become the means for my liberation, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually. Do you experience yourself when you're talking about belief? Do you experience yourself as faithful? Do you have faith in that?
It's a good question, because I was, you know, a very intellectually heavy person, and I was raised to be an atheist. So even when I got convinced of spiritual realities. It was in a very kind of hard-edged way, and I always hated the word faith, and I've always hated Christians, and not personally as individuals, but just generally as a group, and that those kind of beliefs. But at this point, I think I probably would have to cop to a kind of faith, really. But I would say that it's more like a felt sense of absolute trust in something that is present and experienceable. So, whereas faith seems kind of more emotional or mental.
I agree with what you say. Like, I didn't even think about this. Like, I guess this word has really bad connotations. But I mean, in itself, it's a very, I think whatever you do, and you can clearly see that this, you don't build this, these kind of thoughts, they don't grow as a result of faith. You know, like when I read your writing, I can clearly see that probably most of your life, okay, you have not had that, and this is precisely what enabled you to produce a concise, rational thought. But that doesn't mean that, you know, like in a later part of your life, you can integrate this rationality and develop some sort of faith, because of course, I guess everybody sooner or later learns that this like constant erring and destroying yourself with doubt and uncertainty is not very healthy, and that it's good to have some sort of, you know, like when you're talking about, okay, this is a sort of divine intervention, perhaps that is already a subtle divine intervention, that if you actually rationally assess the level of evil that is in the world, that things are going still, I mean, there's still pretty pleasant pockets, and I mean, I guess that already shows that there is like a force that must be forcibly infinitely stronger to even stop this from completely turning.
And even at an individual level, that I can, or one can, explore these things and immerse oneself so deeply in them and yet feel essentially good within it and not in some awful masochistic way. But that it deepens my sense of trust the more I'm able to see. And there is a logical basis also, which is also very individual, very personal, that, like, even as a child, and I think most children have this, but they don't necessarily sustain it, but I always had a sense of the eternal, as a concept, I mean, as in I was frightened by the idea of infinity and eternity, or amazed by them, astonished by them, confounded by them, the thing that you can't think about, but you can't not think about.
Yeah.
Right? And so logic can't banish eternity, or it can't banish infinity. On the contrary, logic has to allow for it. So what happens then, you know, when you kind of live with the infinite and the eternal, and it's a constant presence, it's like its touch transforms everything gradually. Because, like, how can life have meaning in the context of the eternal? It can't, unless there's something that is eternal that lives within that, or that lives within us. And I'm speaking now like logically, but of course this isn't a logical experience. It's a felt experience, but it's bizarre to me that it can be, to some extent, it can be encapsulated by logic. It's not the kind of logic that would convince Doug Lane or, you know, a serious sort of skeptical materialist, but it's not meant to convince. It's just meant to express.
Yeah, exactly. I find it interesting that you say that, but it's more of a physical experience even.
Yeah.
It's sort of a connection to the infinite, which brings us back to the, okay, there's a, I'm convinced that there's a, the body is infinitely more intelligent than we are with our conscious minds. You know, it knows exactly what we need. It's just that most of the time we learn how to effectively ignore it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, there's the wonderful thing about the living is that it heals. You know, if you cut yourself today, it will scar during the next days, and then skin will grow over it, you know. The problem is usually that people keep cutting themselves, you know, they never allow themselves to heal. But I think that's even that, if you have a sense of, okay, there's like something I can access as a body that is somewhere as the infinite, then that already speaks to that. And I think that's something to be trusted and to be pursued. But perhaps it also, yeah, I don't know. I guess a lot of times these things necessitate a certain well-being and a certain healing before that. And I think, yeah. But there's ways to heal, you know. I mean, you just...
It's the detoxification that we were talking about, like at the start today, I think, as you were talking about. The way that drugs, they give the spiders the drugs and they can't build the proper spider webs, they can't create the environment that they actually need to be in, to be healthy in. And of course, food. I mean, to what extent would it be possible or plausible, to use that word, for controlling elites who want to debilitate the people that they want to control, to figure out what kind of foods to give them to eat, and then design all kinds of drugs to basically keep their bodies polluted, to prevent that infinite intelligence from actually being able to express and be, you know, experienced by us, and turn us into these transporters, these carriers for the product that they want to sell, which is essentially poison. It's a very tidy model, right? And yet it's completely plausible, partly because it is so tidy, and yet it implies not total control, because there's no such thing, but incredibly far-reaching control. If you give people the food that they will eat, and you make drugs for them to take, and then you get them to create the very environments that will trap them and ensnare them.
Can you hold this question for a second? I really need to piss.
Yeah, you got it.
Oh,
hear the infinite wisdom of the body speaking.
Yeah, I wondered if you would pick that up.
Well, it's a valid point, I guess. Perhaps there is a certain optimism or ignorance from my side that I still think that this is, it's very difficult to accomplish these things. That even, I mean, social engineering, of course, with the help of the data and internet, gets much more sophisticated today, and perhaps even artificial intelligence. But I think a lot of times it's with, you know, any technology, it has its also has its side effects. So I don't think history just ends in that sense.
What would be the end of history then?
The end of history won't happen. This is precisely my point.
But what would it be?
Well, I suppose complete control and complete arbitrariness in some part over the rest. And I mean, I guess every, you know, whatever you do, it will produce its counter effects and its dialectical antithesis. You know, I mean, there's, yeah, you can ask, you know, also, is there an anthropological limit to stupidity? You know, I mean, how stupid does BuzzFeed have to get before I actually finally, you know, turn it out completely, you know? And I think this is also something that is, that appears to happen at least to some extent. You know, that people just, okay, that they reach a certain limit and then they opt out of these things. Of course, it's hard to assess how exactly this is going to look, but I think a lot of times, I mean, who knows what technology, how far artificial intelligence really is, and how much of a game changer this is. But I think, you know, like, I mean, yeah, as you say, I mean, then again, it's not really in our hands, is it?
No, and that's why whenever I make these seemingly doom-laden statements, they're not coming from a place of that at all, because it's almost like I don't really mind. I mean, the amount of horror that I can hold in awareness is growing every day, you know, and I have no idea where the limit lies. I think, you know, trying to understand the extent, the reach of social engineering and how effective it's been throughout history and up to the present and including the present is a vast enterprise in itself. And I think it also, you know, the more we can adequately understand the reach of social engineering or how effective it's been on us as individuals up to the present, the more we can probably postulate, you know, how far it's going to go and what its actual goals are. And that's kind of separate from the question of where it will end, or I think what you were addressing. I mean, I don't have any worries that, like, the human soul will be forever imprisoned in some transhumanist dystopia created by, you know, mother-bonded sociopathic space porn addicts or whatever. I know it's going to be temporary, but on the other hand, I don't know, it's not going to go on for another 1,000 years. And so it's just kind of just trying to imagine the scope of this, and trying to map the actual goals and the reasons for the goals, and then I guess juxtapose that with how feasible it is. So we do seem to be at a I think is event horizon the term, I'm not sure, but at a point in history where it's becoming possible to see the gulf between the goals and the realizability of them, right? So transhumanism as a goal seems to be manifestly unrealizable, but it's still interesting that it is a goal. And then there's still the question of, well, if they figure out they can't achieve, you know, turning human consciousness into digital data and sending it through space or whatever, what are they going to do instead, or maybe they know they can't achieve that, and that's just a, they've just come up with a, you know, a fictionalized version of what they're attempting to achieve, and we have to read between the lines. But it's in, I mean, it's in your drug chapter, you write about the same logic makes the human being entirely obsolete in the long run. This concept, I think that's very real. I don't think they're going to get rid of human bodies because I think they need them, but I think they want to turn human bodies into machines in some way.
But I guess that human beings already are machines. I mean, if you look at, these people around you, they're, what are they else but like
Well, they're
interfaces?
not. No, they're not though, because machines are human concept, you know, for industrial age, whereas we're talking about technology for the soul. You know, if the body was designed as a vehicle for the soul or the psyche, that, I mean, that's not a machine.
No,
That's
no. Don't get me wrong. That's not my view of the world. But I think the way people are today forcefully integrated into society with schooling, with as employees, which already is, I guess, like completely dehumanizing for every individual. I
Yeah.
think that's very. And I guess these things are increasingly. I mean, I actually have no idea where this is going, because we have these like two movements that, on the one side, these horrible jobs are abandoned by machines, but then it doesn't really, on the other hand side, seem to free human beings up for anything. And we don't even know if that's actually desirable or if that's not complete psychosis. Because what do the human beings do in a world that is sort of where everything, every problem is solved?
Right, because I mean the kind of leisure time that this world is creating for these human beings is even more soul destroying than the work.
I mean, Berlin is a really good example for this. You can just see what happens to human beings if they're unemployed and just have enough money to have fun. But then again, it also depends on what. A lot of times, it seems as if everything we consider today as fun has to do with destroying the body.
Yeah.
It's completely overeating or drinking your pain away or smoking or whatever. I mean, it's not very. Or like having some adrenaline draining extreme sports or something,
A pornography is another one, but it's, you know, it's become a benevolent thing. I guess drugs have to some extent, but they're still illegal, whereas porn, I don't even know what the legality of porn is at this point, but it's definitely becoming more and more of a culturally accepted thing. And so, and then I think a next step is these semi-sentient sex dolls. You know, I mean, if ever machine intelligence or the technology is, if there's one area we can guarantee it's going to be developed in, it would be in that area, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I guess if there's anything you can do is just to, as a writer, or is to perhaps also. I mean, when I hear these things, and I think a lot of people are very serious about these things. I have no doubt about it. Especially when I, talk to American friends, and then they talk to me about space travel and stuff. To me, that's completely. That's really. That's so ridiculous, I mean, why would anyone want to go to Mars? It's like it doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah.
Or, why would anybody have a sentient sex doll? It's always this logic of deprivation and then overcompensation, and of course, so I guess there's a perhaps you're very much at the avant-garde of these things when you move out somewhere into a Canadian village and just try to do something wholesome,
Yeah, sure. And not get be too fascinated by the spectacle. I mean, I have to watch out for that because it is addictive and it can be vicarious. And of course, there is a part of us, obviously, of all of us, that wants to experience these incredibly transgressive thrills being sanctioned by society. I wonder about that, you know, the transgression thing, because like transgression is sold to us, to the youth particularly, in this very cunning way of reverse psychology. You forbid it, but at the same time you make it easily available. So people,
you make it ultimately aesthetic as well.
Yeah, you mean as in aestheticizing, as in it's cool, you mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You forbid it, and at the same time, it's the most aesthetic thing, you know, like it's everywhere. And then, of course, you. It's let's say state sponsored drug advertising does not nowhere near compete with the Velvet Underground, you know, or. Because this is an imbalance.
Yeah, well, what I was wondering about there is like, because there's a real transgression which has got nothing to do with social taboos, and that's a transgression against the body. And those, like, I mean, a lot of the transgressions that are taboos are those things, ironically or tragically, because that's the way they get us to do them. Yeah, they forbid them, and then we'll think, oh, they must be good because they're telling us not to do them. But in fact, they really are transgressing. They really do harm our bodies.
Yeah. But I think even that has its own dialectic. I mean, like, while it may, these things, I mean, drugs, they may have been transgressive in the 1960s. You know, today they're the mainstream. So today the transgressive thing to do would be to precisely not to take any drugs.
Well, it's uncool, but is it transgressive? I mean,
yeah, I mean, transgressive. Well, it's I don't know if we want to stay at this with this word, but if you think about, you know, like even those pop stars that have created today's culture, like David Bowie or Prince, who started off as you know, like with this. At the time, extremely transgressive blending of the genders, and you know, promoting a certain drug lifestyle. So they sort of grew old as these very decent men, you know, like who had, you know, like their, I guess, normal family lives, and were giving to charity and so on. You know, I mean, I find that quite interesting. So there seems to be, perhaps there is that is something positive, you know.
Well, I mean, it worked for me. I'm not sure about David Bowie or Prince. I wouldn't believe the publicity there. But it seems to work for me in that I had a period of extreme transgression, not extreme by today's standards, and then settled into a wholesome middle age without becoming boring or bored. So I think at a microcosmic level, absolutely. I think at a social level or a larger level, it's less apparent to me that although I'm sure it's there, that people are wising up earlier and transgressing in a healthy sense, as in just listening to their bodies and rejecting the social trends and cues. But I also, and one of the things that struck me about as interesting about Pizzagate is this notion of transgression as cool. And that if the transgression is cool, then it's okay. So, because a lot of the Pizzagate thing centered on the art, the taste in art, and the artistic performance of what's her name, Abramovich. Really dark, nasty stuff, I would say, personally. And then, of course, James Alefantis' Instagrams, which isn't art, but it's an expression of his personality. And, you know, really overtly pedophile humor there, if you even call it humor, that is obviously very transgressive, even just as humor, never mind as actual, if it's pointing to actual, you know, child abuse. And yet it was couched, or at least it got put in this context of, well, this is the culture and it's just hip, edgy art, gay culture, so it's okay. So that, I mean, that I think that's signaling something. And that is what I discovered, I think, with my brother, by looking at him in the context of Jimmy Savile and Glamour Magic. Oh, yeah, he was part of a world that is cool and hip and edgy and artistic, precisely in proportion to how transgressive it is willing to be.
Mm-hmm.
Which is quite scary, really.
Absolutely. I mean, I guess... yeah, perhaps it's something to. I mean, if you look at what has come out of like the last 50 years of modern art, and it's particularly interesting as well in Germany, where I'm from, where sort of the CIA funded art avoided themes of mythology, which were until then, especially in Nazi Germany, there was the predominant thing, you know, like German myth and, you know,
right.
boys and girls and whatever. And it was turned into the sort of, these things were forbidden for the West German artists. They just wouldn't become famous if they would continue on with this, with this sort of style. And what happened was that the art moved and remained sort of, this school of art remained somewhere in East Germany. And today, some of the most expensive artists, like Neo Rauch, for example, is a Leipzig-based artist who is from this school of sort of Nazi mythology themes, becomes one of the most expensive artists. Because he sort of preserved this tradition, and there's something in people that makes them want to see this, perhaps.
Right.
So I think it's always difficult to, you know, a lot of these things, what we look at today as modern art, I mean, what's going to be left of it? Not much, you know. I mean, in most things, I think people are just going to laugh at it, some like silly inside joke of the speculating establishment, you know, like Damien Hirst or whatever, you know. And so it's tough to say how much of this is actually going to prevail, or if the next thing in art is not going to be the exact opposite and something that is much less cruel.
Right. Although, of course,
I can't know that, you know, but I think if you're a smart artist today and you want to do something subversive, you do the exact opposite, you know, you do something that's not transgressive at all in that sense, you know.
Right. Well, I mean, I would say that these people are not artists that we're talking about in any true sense of the word. I don't like the whole concept of art at this point in my life, even though I'm happy if you see what I'm doing as artistic. But you put it in the very context that I think is meaningful, which is self-healing. And I think there have always been artists who express for self-healing, and then the product, you know, the side effect is the art and people appreciate it. But I think there's been more and more this, you know, cultural commodification of art, which has gone hand in hand with art as a cloak for transgression or as a justification for it.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. But then again, it's always difficult what conclusions to draw from this, because I can see that how a lot of people are then already pointing at fingers at, okay, then let's restrict the freedom of expression, and then it turns into the other way again.
Yeah.
I think art is many things, you know, but art can also be used to offer a context for people to take, to convey a message that, where they're sort of, they can, oh, okay, it's just art, you know, but then you can convey an idea, and it allows the idea, you allow the idea to grow in people's head, just because they're not forced to take it seriously at face value, which for a lot of times that's the exact problem for people. It's that, no, I can't read this, you know, because I don't agree with this. I can't even expose myself to this thought, you know?
Yeah.
It's just this, like, okay, you don't really want that either, you know? And okay, we are living in a society, which I think is part of why at least Western society has been extremely successful in the past, is that it has established its freedom of information. Sort of this, okay, you can write and say whatever you want, and of course that goes into all sorts of ways. And I guess ideally in a society you don't have to make any, you don't forbid anything, but you know, people just won't react to it. You know, it's just you see a particular artwork and you say, oh, that's just bad taste, you know.
Yeah. Talking here that we're talking about art in a similar to way that we've been talking about drugs and food as these cultural delivery devices that inform society, as inform it internally, because they inform human beings, right? Mm-hmm. And so CIA and the impressionist modern art movement, that superficially, at least I would say it was much deeper, but superficially it had to do with sending the message that the US was a free democratic society, unlike the Soviet Union, look at our art, right? Mm-hmm. And then juxtapose that, if that's the word, whatever, compare that with the Nazi Germany thing that was kind of notorious now, that, you know, that they were extremely censorious of artists that they considered decadent artists, art that might, you know, propagate decadent ideas and behaviors. So in both cases we've got art, the recognition that art is an ideological influence, a tool for ideological influence.
Yeah, which is I guess the very, very Marxist perspective, that there is nothing outside of outside of ideology, which is today most of the art world is probably, you know, although toying with this idea, they're still, you know, like, I mean, if you look at most art, there's nothing, or this kind of transgressiveness that we're talking about is not transgressive at all, because that is, except it's just a, you know, like, plain representation of the brutal society that we live in and become accustomed to.
And a glamorization of it, even.
Yeah, glamorization, banalization.
Yeah. Oh yeah, or both. Yeah, I had to recognize that about my brother, really, in the end. He was actually quite conventional. Like, he created this big show of being this subversive, iconoclastic personality, but look deeper at the very culture that he's rebelling against, and he was actually just magnifying it.
Yeah. But it would be interesting to know how he would, you know, like, in light of today's culture, if he would still produce the same art, you know, maybe he would do something completely different. Or perhaps, I mean, I guess I didn't know your brother, but perhaps he was completely caught up in this persona and but I think,
I think he, yeah.
I think for a good artist, that fame is a challenge and is a moment to go into him or herself again and see, okay, is that if society actually promotes it, is it still art?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
There's always something to, if you're a good artist, you would be extremely skeptical. And I think some people understand that and then they act accordingly, which I have a lot of respect for, you know, if you can have that and if you're not too much tempted by that, because a lot of times perhaps your intention with that is good, you know, like, I mean, I guess my life has been transgressive for the most part in the bad way, but I still had also perhaps this noble intention of, you know, producing something good, you know. It was not like I was trying to corrupt the world, you know. It's just like unconsciously I corrupted myself and those around me, but you know, I was just not mature enough to see that. Didn't have the distance from it.
Yeah, same. I'd say the same about the earlier books I wrote and stuff that I was, and I was trying to, wake people up or bring the truth. And the same things I want to do now, but I've had to radically recalibrate my methods and my focus there. A big part of it, and this is what Seen and Not Seen was about, is recognizing the unconscious ideology that we've become carriers of and transmitters of. Because I never consider myself ideologically affiliated or influenced, because I was always anti-political and even anti-religious. I didn't recognize, as the fish doesn't recognize water, that the ideological implant that I'd taken unconsciously was much subtler, and it was the movies and the arts, you know. And that's exactly why they're so powerful. Like you were saying, people don't, there are, you know, a lot of people don't want to be propagandized in any way that's obvious. They have this sense that real art and real awareness and understanding has to be free from the shackles of ideology. So then they are a little bit more discerning, and then it has to be, they have to be Trojan horse. You know, they have to be presented with this beautiful object and open their gates to it, and then, of course, out come the Trojans.
Yeah, I mean, it's always interesting. I mean, if you look at, I mean, I went to university, and to me, it's always the most ideological vulnerable people are people in universities. You know, if they're sometimes I feel they have the most standardized opinions.
Yeah.
That you can create. I mean, if you I find that interesting as well, that there's this, like, in France, I guess people say the bon sens populaire, the how would you say, the common sense of the people. That you just, when you have somebody who's not very educated, that you just can't sell them anything. They have this sort of there's a barrier somewhere. They can't just intellectualize everything. They take a Pollock for just splatter paint or something, you know,
right.
Because it cannot be trained into your
cultural immune system.
Yeah, it's a cultural immune system, yeah. And that's very interesting. Culture itself is an immune system, and also the opposite. But to think about how art can become a creator of a sensible cultural immune system. And I think you're actually very close to that when I read your stuff. Yeah.
Well, it's hard for me to take, but I'm going to take it. I want to deflect it and say, no, it's not possible. And that's the paradox, you know, the heart of everything I do and say, I think, for me at least, is somehow it's all... what works for oneself, if it really works, and if sharing it is part of that development of a true immune system, by which we don't let the bullshit in, we don't let the Trojans in, somehow, it's by example. It's like art by example. But I reject the artist audience polarity. That's partly a big part of doing this podcast. And so, you know, you read what I do, I read what you do. We have a conversation. It's a meeting of minds and maybe souls. And something comes out of that that's much more real than your or my book. Or, you know, it's there's a living thing that's happening there. And then the art's just a means for that connection to happen. That somehow keeps it, for me, that keeps it more real. And even though I'm not saying I don't feel proud of the work I do and attached to it, I do, but I also know that that's kind of a slippery slope for me in terms of identifying with the stuff I do and, you know, thinking that it somehow gives more value to me as an individual. I know that just can't be true.
Yeah, and I mean, for me, just personally, there's also something really great about it, you know, because, like, let's say you were, what you're doing would actually be appreciated and you would be part of the cultural establishment. It would be much more difficult for me to just give you a Skype call and discuss this.
Well, if that starts to happen, I hope you will give me a Skype call and tell me to, you know, get my head straight and stop becoming...
That's the interesting thing about it, you know. I was quite grateful that the people I've met in my life that I found interesting were a lot of times very, very accessible.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's because my taste in things, I suppose, varies radically from what is considered popular or what makes money and generates attention.
Well, there's that. I mean, if you find people on the margins, as you said, they're going to be more accessible. But I also think it's a gauge of how honest somebody is to what they're doing. Because, like, I had that experience with Jonathan Leeson. I was going to ask you about him because you're writing about Berlin, and he was just written about Berlin. But just to finish, he was very accessible and very responsive. And the fact that he was this cultural figure... didn't seem to make any difference to his availability or his openness. I'm not saying that's true across the board. He may be an asshole for all I know, another, but with me, he was entirely open and responsive and that. So that's a gauge I have now. Like, if I see something, somebody's doing work I like, I reach out to them before I even go deeper into it. And if they don't respond, I just move on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I can also see how if you're, you know, in the center of attention, then you'll probably have so many requests that it becomes very difficult.
Yeah.
I don't know, Leatham and it sounds, I guess, interesting. If you're interested in getting in that guy, I'll look him up.
Yeah, his last novel was Gamma's Anatomy, and it takes place in Berlin and then California, and he's definitely into the Berlin thing. I think he'd be interested by your book, actually, because I didn't quite understand some of the things he was saying about Berlin, but I'm pretty sure they intersect with what you're writing about in certain ways. It's about a gambler who develops a facial tumor while he's in Berlin and begins to lose his identity, and so it's like he has his death experience in Berlin. So I'm pretty sure there's something there that would resonate between the two works.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, and I mean, there's something about this. People who are working on exploration that might someday get recognized or identified as art, that we're trying to tune into the implicate order, you know, the coherence that's underneath everything, the real structure of existence. And so we meet, you know, kindred souls. When we find a lead and we follow it, we'll run into somebody who's following a similar lead, and that feels very real and nourishing.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, it does. I was actually also looking really, I was really looking forward to talking to you. Yeah.
Well, that's cool.
It's nice. It's really like this, it's just, I really appreciate this quality to openly consider things and just, you know, without fully, you don't need to fully subscribe to them, but okay, entertain the idea. And I see that a lot, you know, there's a lot of ideas in what you're doing. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's more instinctive, intuitive, and because it's not just playing with ideas, and but
Of
it's
course,
going
you
in a little bit blind. You don't really know.
the interest. I mean, I think probably like throughout life, you at least I feel this way for me. I only pursue one idea, but it takes different forms. And I just chase that more or less, and that's all I do. That it takes the most different forms, you know. But,
Yeah, that's exactly it. Something that's hidden, that's what it's been for me, I think. There's always something hidden, and I'm trying to find what it is.
yeah, but also something that pulls the things together and gives it meaning.
Yeah, well, that's the same thing, I think. It's like the unconscious.
Peel away the layers and also understanding the other and its manifestations, you know.
Yeah, I see it as developing an eye, really. Like the thing that I'm trying to see, it's not really about seeing that thing. It's about developing the ability to see everything in the way that I'm trying to see that one particular thing, which is without judgment, really, without trying to change it, just see it. And I guess that's why infinity, eternity, God, trauma, those big things, they're the things, because you can't judge those things. You can only try and have the whatever it takes to actually see them. Not look away, I guess. I don't want to say what it is, whether it's courage or stubbornness or insanity, or but just.
Yeah, it's interesting also this idea of judgment, because I guess a lot of times the way you browse society, and especially if you deal with this dark stuff, you know, like the dark matter of it, the underlying like extreme violence that seems to be at the root of every all of our social institutions, that in itself is a value judgment. And I guess it's this, you know, you're what are the disappointed kids, you know, that who are looking at that's not the way we've been promised it, you know. And then you start going at, but I think it's interesting what you say, that you also you and I think with this judgment you're talking about is the sort of the very material judgment that you do not want to overthrow or violently turn something around, which would then like lead just to the next phase of chaos and overcompensation, but to actually look at it together and then like in this way heal and perhaps also reconcile, you know. Then it's important to have an idea of reconciliation, you know, to sort of to open the door. I mean, I can only speak for myself, but I've also changed a lot in my life, you know. Like there's a lot of things that I've done in my life that I wouldn't condone anymore nowadays, you know. So I guess it's not on the same level as torturing children and creating super soldiers, or but you know, on a much smaller scale, you know, somewhere.
Well, I don't rule it out. I haven't been able to. Mean, that's part of looking and just keep looking and just not closing off any avenue, really. It's like everything, no matter how unthinkable, has to be left as a possibility.
Dude, that's a very how would you say, virile task, even, you know.
Virile.
Virile, yeah, sorry, my English sometimes. Yeah, it's even, I can remember that the first time, I guess there's a moment when you go beyond the official narrative that is quite painful, right? you sort of discover something that the layer hidden underneath, and then you just have to you have to go there step by step. You can't take it all in at once, or you're like going outside of it. I mean, I don't know how that was with you. I mean, that was my experience. As I didn't MK Ultra was my first step into it was like a slow unlayering of the state, you know, and then to understand that the state consists of individuals and networks, and that these individuals are subject to socialization, and to there is this extreme inertia of power that seems to reproduce itself in every generation, and I don't know. I forgot the point I was trying to make.
Well, it was very eloquently put. I think we're sort of running out of fuel here, so
yeah,
that's probably why. Like it was opening up to a whole new discussion. Actually, that last thing you were saying. So
yeah,
that's probably why you lost the thread. So I'm like, no, I'm not gonna respond to that.
Okay, good. It's good because I've also reached my time limit because I have to go to work.
Oh, well, there you go.